Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
Joining me in center ring today, we have Brian Steffen. Brian is a therapist and a social worker. He specializes in suicide prevention and grief. And there's a whole lot to talk about, just in general, suicide and grief. And then we're going to talk about it in context with divorce. And I'm so happy you're here, Brian, because I know you've spoken about this. You've dealt with this a lot. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
So, Brian, suicide, grief. Let's talk about that first. We kind of know what grief is. Let's focus on what causes suicide. What causes people to have suicide ideation? Is that how you say it?
That's exactly right.
What is suicide ideation?
That's a great question. And what we know now and what we're able to talk about now, these are very different types of conversations that were had maybe 20 years ago, certainly 50 years ago. These are taboo topics and have been for a long time. Less so now because of discussions like this. Also because of high-profile deaths. One of the most important moments in our field of suicidology came with Marilyn Monroe's death. So her death in the early 60s and her being a global figure, similar to Robin Williams, Anthony Bourdain, Kate Spade, and others. But Marilyn Monroe's death really shocked not only the country, but the world. And afterwards, in Los Angeles, here in LA.
Brentwood,
there you go. Mm-hmm. And there was an investigation, as there often is, with the coroner's office and the authorities trying to determine the nature of the death. And in that case, there was questions as to whether or not Marilyn Monroe's death was an accidental or intentional. Perhaps intentional suicide. And so there were some researchers that got together, three gentlemen by the name of Schneidman, Barbaro, and Littman, and they conducted their investigation, and they determined that her death was a probable suicide. And because Marilyn Monroe is Marilyn, everyone paid attention, and this became, this conversation was started, really. It started with her death. And so what happened is these three gentlemen who were focused on studying suicide, they found themselves all of a sudden being inundated with phone calls from people not only in Los Angeles, but throughout the country and wanting to know, hey, I read about your investigation. You know, my uncle is struggling and I'm wondering if you have some advice. And people would call and say, hey, you know, I'm struggling myself. I'm feeling stuck and I can't talk about this with anybody. I was wondering, I read in the newspaper about your work for Marilyn. In those circumstances, can you help me? And the reason I'm giving this history is it's important because, again, these are taboo topics. The big, things that we don't talk around the dinner table. They got so many calls, in fact, and so much attention that these three researchers, they got their spouses, they got their neighbors, they got their friends to even come and answer calls. And ever since, we have the first national suicide crisis hotline where people can call. And so I just wanted to share that little history because that we can now talk about suicide ideation, which is those thoughts and those feelings where we wonder often privately to ourselves, do I want to keep doing this? You know, these thoughts that come to so many of us at one point or another in our lives, the research now suggests that everyone, almost everyone, if not everyone, will experience these very human thoughts of, I wonder if I didn't wake up tomorrow. I wonder if my life would be any better. Or I wonder if I got hit by a bus. I wonder if that would improve my situation. It's just often what we talk about at the suicide crisis hotline, which I've worked at for the past 6 years. We say that, yeah, thoughts of suicide are very human, even though it can feel so scary and feel why. You know, people often call and say, why am I thinking about this? And thank goodness there's safe harbors like the crisis hotline. And also conversations like this where we can spread the message that it's okay to feel like I'm not sure if I want to keep going. Often suicidal ideation, as you said, that ideation, it's a normal response to an abnormal situation. And there's so many.
It's a release, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a release.
It's a release from this crushing, oppressive situation that I found myself in. And I think you're right, Brian, in that probably most of us have said, okay, better I check out now. Let's just get rid of this. But there's a difference between a person who says that is a casual, just momentary release versus someone who is serious. I really can't stand the pain. What's happening with the person who's serious?
Well, I think what you just said is exactly it. You know, the release. And if we can't have any kind of release or relief, again, just a little bit of history, because I think it's helpful. For a long time, medical professionals, mental health professionals like myself, back in the day, we thought that suicide only happened to other people. It was kind of that mindset. It only happened to, and the language back then was very pathological or pathologizing. Suicide only touched those who had a major mental illness. It was even that kind of language. But now we know that it's when the stressors of life pile up. It's when the stressors, the financial stressors, when the relationship and the romance stressors pile up, when our health concerns, you know, chronic pain, when we have identity kind of stressors. Okay, who am I now that my relationship is dissolved? All I've ever been was a husband or a wife. Who am I now that I'm alone? You know, these kind of stressors, and thank goodness that we know that now, that when we have the stressors of life pile up in front of us, sometimes I imagine it's like a boulder in the road. And it feels like there's no way to navigate it or traverse it or get around it. And that's just one boulder. But for many of us, there's more than one. And we cannot see the future. I mean, literally in this imagining being on a road of life, even though our life isn't linear, we can't see the future. It's so dark. We may not be able to go backwards. We're stuck. And in that stuckness, and like you said, it's hard to get release and relief when we feel stuck. And just the last little point about it is that, again, there's so much stigma around mental health and suicide. So people are suffering in silence. And if you imagine that the suffering, right, the suffering often is the stressors. The suffering is the financial, the relationship, the romance, the health, the identity, the life. So that is the suffering. And we all need help navigating the suffering. But the silence, right, when you're suffering in silence, it's the silence, I think, that really is where suicide ideation, fantasies, plans, attempts, and deaths, it's the silence piece. It's silence that kills. And I'm glad that we're now talking about it and not keeping things silent anymore.
You said when you were listing the different stressors, Brian, financial, relationship-related, physical pain, supposedly Robin Williams, but people in physical pain want to be put out of it. And then image, identity. When you're going through a divorce, your identity really does change from husband or wife to single person. And that you may never have been a single person before. You may have gone from graduating from college, graduating from high school, living at home to all of a sudden you're married without any in between of living on your own and finding out who you are and developing yourself beyond your development within your family home. And these transitions are important, aren't they?
Oh, tremendously important. You know, we started dating at 17. We got married at 23. We met, we started dating at 24. We got married at 29. I mean, the ages don't matter, but I think your point, which is, it's so important. I hadn't thought about it until right now, that maybe I'm in a relationship, right? And sure, I do all the, maybe I like doing the numbers. I like doing my monthly expenses. Okay, that's my part. That's my job in the relationship. But for many years, there's other aspects of our life that we've built together. Maybe we have kids, maybe not. And after being married for a few years, I'm alone. I'm single. And yes, as far as the, maybe in that relationship, in that family unit, I was doing the monthly expenses, but now I have all of these other things, all of these other things that need to get done. I don't know who I'm supposed to ask, how you're supposed to cook eggs. And I'm so ashamed. You know, I heard that you can microwave them, but now I'm, you know, these.
Wait, I have an easy answer. You can ask the waiter. So you can go out to eat. I've fixed that one problem.
And it's so interesting that, no, it's.
For me, that's what I would do. I'm thinking, how would I get around that? Oh, I just eat out. So, okay, but go ahead. Brian, to your point,
I love this because, and people call the crisis hotline. And the stories that people share, and again, thank goodness, I've learned so much at the crisis hotline. I think I learned as much, if not more, in the crisis hotline than I did in graduate school. Because on the lines, you're hearing the truth. And for many of us, it's hard to find a place where we can be 100% honest. I mean, I'm a therapist, but even I struggle being honest with my own therapist. Because it's hard to just lay it out there. And something about the suicide crisis hotline, which is throughout the country here in Los Angeles, in Century City, we get somewhere between 130 and 150,000 calls every year. And once people know that this is not a space where they'll be judged, they'll be told what to think, what to do, how to feel, and they know that it's really amazing. It's 24/7, it's free, it's private and confidential. And then people can share and they can say things like, you know, today's my first day being single. And I never thought that I would be coming home to an empty house. I never in my wildest dreams thought that after working for many years, being in a relationship, having a kid or two, I would ever come home to an empty, dark house. And I feel really hopeless. I feel really disconnected. And I don't even want to go in the kitchen. And I just wanted to say that out loud. And thank goodness that there are safe places where we can share and say, yeah, I don't know how to make eggs. Or, you know, I don't know how to meet someone again. It's the little things that I think can contribute and add up, like as we were talking about before, about the stressors of life. And it's really, it's the suffering in silence.
It's the way you described the inner dialogue of this example, going home to an empty, dark house, which I am sure reflects how they feel inside, empty and dark, because you could enjoy going home. Oh my God, the space is my own. I can do anything I want with it. That's the other side of how you can look at things. But but what I'm getting is a person that has suicide ideation, you won't look at it as this is to my advantage. This will always be to my disadvantage. And by the way, I know exactly where the suicide crisis hotline is. I pass it on the way to work. It's on the corner of Olympic and Century Park East.
Exactly.
I know exactly where it is. And I often thought, geez, that would be so interesting to work there. I'm not a therapist, so I'm not qualified, but so interesting to work there because...
Well, actually, you know, just to let you know, by the way, we're the only suicide, to my knowledge, we're the only suicide prevention crisis hotline center in the country that has the word suicide prevention on the side of the building.
Oh.
Even among crisis hotlines, there is some, but, and also just to let you know, and if anyone's listening, when I volunteered there, we're operating in a paraprofessional capacity, which is so great that, because I wanted to volunteer, but I wasn't a therapist at the time either.
Oh.
And it's so great because it has a quality, the conversations, they have a quality of friendliness. And it's almost like two people sitting on a park bench or, you know, when you're on a, say, a plane or a bus or a train and you sit down next to someone and there's just something about that person who you feel safe with and you feel like you can start talking and you do. You start
right.
talking about childhoods and life and it has that quality to it too.
Nice.
It's the emotional and psychological safety. So it's really amazing how, you know, earlier, again, in our discussion today, you mentioned the word grief. And yes, there's many types of grief, including when we lose the people that we love and the animals and the pets too. This is also a type of grief, you know, saying goodbye to a chapter in our lives, the transitions. And just like the grief of a sibling, a parent, a child, a partner, a friend, those grief experiences need to be witnessed. Keeping grief inside, it's possible to get through it, but something about grief and love needs to be witnessed. And I think the other type, you know, these things need to be witnessed by someone else. You know, we all do need each other fundamentally.
But what do you mean by witness? That I don't understand.
So
in terms of grief.
Yeah. So just going back to that example that we were talking about that just came to me, coming home, Charles, Barbara, they come home to a home. They come home to a dark house and it strikes them. I mean, that is a pretty jarring imagery, even me just saying that out loud. And I wonder how different that inner dialogue, that story that they're telling themselves, and we all tell ourselves stories. Some of us, our stories can be quite unkind, you know, at times. And having those stories inside our head, and you know what? I guess this is what a loser's life looks like. A dark home with an empty fridge, with bed sheets and pillow slips that haven't been changed in more than a week. I guess this is what a lost life looks like. And keeping those things inside, and where it's sometimes it's the debate society, no, I'm not a loser. Well, yeah, you are. Look at your fridge. Versus sharing that with someone. Now, I think your examples of the other side, okay, freedom, you can do what you want, opportunity to start a new chapter. Sometimes we do have people in our lives that are kind of forcing those messages on us. Listen, Barbara, this is it. You're single. Don't you see how great this is? And that's okay. But first, you know, first.
Yeah, it doesn't address the pain.
The pain and the grief, the love.
Has to be witnessed.
Grief, yes.
There you go with the witnessing.
Yeah, and therapists are great for that too. But I want to acknowledge that this is not easy because we're talking about some of the big issues here. We're talking about love. We're talking about grief, sometimes sex and intimacy. So it can be hard. I've heard stories where people have therapists and therapists can say, ooh, you know, can we move on? I mean, to be able to find people who get it, and I'm sure your listeners do get it, because isn't it, don't we want when we're talking to someone, I mean, maybe we still deep down in that child, kind of that young part of us, we want people to tell us what to do. Just tell me what to wear. Just tell me what to eat. Tell me what job to have. But while that's valid, I think as the grown-ups, maybe the child part of us too, we want someone, I know I want someone to say, me too. Me too, Brian. I know, I get it. You know, I remember listening to Oprah's Super Soul Sunday during COVID, and she said that in her experience, she said that the three most beautiful, loving words that one person can say to another, she used to think it was, I love you. But after many years, she's realized that it's not, I love you. She said the kindest thing that one person can say to another person is actually, I hear you. And I love that. I love that. Yeah. I hear you.
Yeah. No, I was thinking that right before you said it. I think that's it. Because in this world of mass communication, we have a lot of miscommunication. So mass communication, we don't repeat exactly what people say. We misunderstand. We deal with the written word, text, and emails, and there's no voice context. You really don't know what somebody's intending. And so in this mass communication world, our ability to miscommunicate is at an all-time high. And how horrible to be dealing with somebody who may have a tendency towards suicide and to say something whose the meaning of which is completely misinterpreted and causing strife, grief, and potential harm, that would be horrifying. That would be horrifying.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Brian, how do you know the difference between accidental and intentional? How did these three people who were looking at Marilyn Monroe's death determine intentional, not accidental?
That's a great question. And currently, and what they did was really the beginning of the field as we know it. This was the beginning of the field of suicidology, and their effort in Marilyn Monroe's death was a high profile example of what we call psychological autopsies. So a psychological autopsy, just very briefly, would be gathering information from friends and loved ones, having conversations. Right. Yeah. It would also be looking at, and this is something that those of us who are trained in psychological autopsies, we would look at suicide notes or letters, correspondences. These days, we often see emails and text messages and social media postings. So the days of strictly kind of, you know, suicide notes and letters, hard copy, they're not the only types. Now people leave messages in different ways. So there's a lot of different ways that we can map out and look at the days and weeks and months leading up to the death. And in the case of Marilyn Monroe, they determined that based on the conversations and the interviews and the documentation that it was a probable suicide. And just about Marilyn Monroe, I mean, one of the most beloved and renowned and revered, like Robin Williams. And I bring up that connection because we never know how lonely, we never know how disconnected Anthony Bourdain, and there's so many others too. The person that I personally lost to suicide, every person that she ever met loved her, and a deep love, a genuine love, not a superficial love. But despite the love and the support and the friendliness and the, still people can feel so disconnected. And I hope we'll never go back to the days where it's not suicide, it's the S word, right? And we keep these things buried away in the basement or in the closet.
It is really hard to talk about suicide because it's the ultimate act of sadness. It's the ultimate act when there's a lack of hope. And to walk into that as a friend, as a companion, as a family member, to walk into that, I don't know that any of us really know what to do or say or handle it. One thing, the other thing is, what if you make it worse?
Yeah. Like
just what if your good intentions didn't work out as intended?
Yeah, we get so many calls at the crisis hotline. I don't have the percentage of the breakdown, but let's say there are 130 to 150,000 calls every year. Let's just say that somewhere between a quarter and a third of them are from loved ones and family members, or friends and family, what we call third-party calls. So we get calls from people and said, I'm really worried about my daughter. Mm. I'm really worried about my best friend. I'm really worried about my dad. I'm really worried about my grandma. And I know something's going on, but they express is what you just said, but I don't want to make it worse. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to make their suffering greater. And thank goodness, I've learned so much, not only from the training and the experience, but the stories of people who call. And thank goodness we can keep reminding each other, even though it's uncomfortable and it can be hard to witness someone else's suffering and their tears, is that we cannot make it worse. Talking about emotions, talking about heartbreak, talking about grief, letting people tell their story, it does not make them feel worse. Although for a long time, this is exactly what we thought. And just as a quick timeout and a parallel, isn't this the kind of conversations that we had for a long time about sex education in schools? You know, okay, right. Everybody, we need to be very careful. Don't you dare talk about this, lest the kiddos and the teenagers, right. So just like we know now that sex education does not make people go and engage, in fact, the opposite, you know, healthy sex education. And we also know that talking about suicide doesn't make people worse because, and this is a big because, maybe I should have started with this, but I'm glad I'm saying it now, is talking to people, all the research, all the lived experience, suicide ideation is not, nobody wants to be dead. Okay, suicide is not about being dead. For a long time, this was one of the kind of misunderstandings is that people want to be dead. No, suicide ideation and suicidality, it's not about wanting to be dead. It's about when the pain of being alive is so great that it seems like that's the key. And once we once we see that shift, it's almost like one of those, you know, when you're staring at the profile of a candelabra and then all of a sudden it's a profile of a face. That shift, it can be so helpful for family and friends. Oh, they don't want to be dead. It's the pain of their life, the stressors, the money, the relationships, the chronic pain, the identity, the what am I doing with my life? That is where the suicidality lives. And we all have stories to tell. And when we keep the stories to ourselves, shame, embarrassment, guilt. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine said to me many years ago, he was helping me, and he said, Brian, when we keep things to ourselves and we deny it, the things that we know want to come out, he said, when you keep it to yourself, it goes down to the basement and lifts weights. And something about that really struck me. It goes down to the basement and lifts weights. Now, I admit it can be very hard to talk about, you know, I'm done. That's hard to say. It's also very hard to say, I've lost someone. It can be very hard to admit, yeah, I've had thoughts. Even though we know that everyone thinks about these things at different times, it's so human. But for a long time, we've been told, either in our cultures or our families or our religions or et cetera, that this is inhuman, it's unhuman, it's non-human. Humans don't think this way. But the fact is, no, we all do think about our own suffering.
We're told it's a sin. In many religions,
that's right.
It's a sin. It's a sin to take your own life. And so that in and of itself, I think, prevents the discussion from happening. At least on the part of the person who's feeling badly.
Yeah.
Before we go right into how we deal with this in a divorce, if we know that we're married to somebody that has this propensity, I wanted you to explain a concept that you had explained to me previously when we initially talked and we met. And you said the opposite of suicide is connection. Please talk about that a little bit.
I love that. That is the phrase that I think is most helpful for me when I'm doing suicide prevention, whether I'm talking to a client who is struggling with ideation or groups. I also facilitate attempt survivor groups. And again, this topic is just shows up in so many different places in so many different ways. So this is borrowing from an expression in the world of 12-step programs. And in the world of 12-step programs, they do say that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. And for some people, that's addiction to alcohol, drugs, food, shopping, sex, pornography, many different unhealthy relationships, a lot of different ways that shows up. And the word connection, the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. So connection to what, right? Connection to ourselves and the kind of honesty. It is really hard to be honest with ourselves. Connection with others. And the others, I think we talked about this a little bit ago too. Safe relationships, you know, emotionally and psychologically safe relationships. We all need, I certainly need, relationships with people who do not tell me what to think and don't tell me what to feel and certainly don't tell me what to do. One of the last things we ever do at a suicide crisis hotline, even though it could seem counterintuitive at first, we don't ever tell people not to kill themselves. Because it's how invalidating, you know, to say to somebody, you know, you're a mom, you have three kids. What are you doing? You know, first of all, that mom already is feeling low and probably has a lot of feelings of some feelings already, however we want to describe them. And the fact of the matter is that each of us is in control of our own lives. We are allowed to be married to who we want to. We are allowed to go where we want to. We are allowed to say to people, don't touch me. And for one person to say to another, you can't do this or you can do it, it removes that autonomy. And I know a lot of people who are involved with or touched by divorce in different ways, perhaps the feelings of, I am not in control of so much of this. Who I am, my identity, my finances, where I'm living, I don't feel like I'm in control of in aspects of my life. And that can be really destabilizing. So connection, just going back to the opposite of suicide or the opposite of suffering, you know, deep suffering, the opposite of suicide is not just the absence of those thoughts, right? The opposite of suffering isn't just no suffering. The opposite of suffering is connection. So connection with ourselves, connection with other people who are not offering us conditional love, you know, love. And then the final connection that I just want to say is it's also connection to, what are we doing here? What am I going to do with this one precious life? Somebody told me a few years ago, he said, Brian, this is not the rehearsal. This is the show. This is it. And I know some of us forget that. I forget it many mornings. It's almost like, no, this is just it'll go on forever. That connection to our big whys or our meaning. What am I? You know what? I divorced. You know, it was 9 years. Okay, you know what? I finally am gonna, I think I'm ready to get behind the wheel of my life and go back to school. Because I just know I've always wanted to work in the library system. I just love library management and I just want to do it. And again, none of us need to walk around and say, you shouldn't be married to that person. You shouldn't be working in this job. You shouldn't cut your bangs. I mean, it's so interesting how these little, it feels like indignities sometimes when each of us can decide for ourselves, you know, that connection to our why. What am I going to do with this precious life? And again, I know you and your listeners and people in this community really get it. Something profound happens when we go through a big life transition. It's not a reset. It just kind of clarifies things. There's an opportunity for real growth, tremendous growth. And I know this happens in the world of grief. From my boss, Jennifer Levin, she talks about from grief to growth. You know, there is an opportunity, something about our heart and our love matures. Our perspective matures. It's true with trauma too. They talk about post-traumatic growth. And so long as we are not keeping things to ourselves, we are finding safe people with whom to reason things out with and brainstorm and collaborate and just have someone nodding their head and saying, yes, yes, me too. It turns out we grow tremendously. Nobody asks, nobody when they were young, 8 years old, thinking, when I grow up, I really want to get divorced. Nobody, right?
Right.
But when we find ourselves in these situations, it can be and has been an opportunity for tremendous growth. And the person that they are after they've been through that dark period, that hardship and that suffering, there's a self-love and a self-respect and a self-regard that perhaps they didn't think possible. So the connection, the opposite of suffering is connection.
So when somebody you know, bares their soul and says, you know, I've been thinking about suicide. I feel helpless. You know, I really don't know what to do. I would think that saying, oh my God, you have three beautiful children. You have everything to look forward to. You have this, you have that. I would think that that's piling stressors on top of the already very stressed out, because they have already thought about this and processed it in a way where their world is crashing down on them. So I'm thinking anybody listening who is either getting divorced to somebody who's depressed and that you are concerned it might lead to suicide, to have them look at their lives in the way you would look at their lives is too much pressure. The only thing to deal with, if I'm getting this right, Brian, is you focus on their pain. You let them express themselves in any way they want. You provide no judgment. You provide no escape route. You just let them talk. Now, if that happens, Brian, and they just talk, what does the listener do when the person is done talking?
That was great. And by the way, this is, I mean, you could train our counselors, because that's exactly what we say, really, is sit in the dark place. Sit in that darkness. Sit with them in those dark feelings. Brené Brown and all of her research and all her TED Talks. And this is what it's all about. The vulnerability to sit with someone in the dark place rather than trying to pull them out of it. And so when people can share, and it's absolutely okay to say to people empathetic statements like, you must feel so overwhelmed. You must be so exhausted. The word exhaustion often comes to me when I'm talking to people at the crisis hotline or as a therapist talking to clients. It's exhausting. You know, the stressors of life are exhausting. You know, sometimes you wake up in the morning, you've got a few seconds when you're in between sleep and wakefulness, and you just a little bit, and then you remember. And then you remember everything. You know, you remember. And it's
this shit I have to do today. Oh no.
And it's exhausting. And so when people are talking, that we can say thank you. If you ever don't know what to say to someone, say thank you so much for saying that. And if you can relate, and I, again, going back to what I said earlier and throughout this conversation, this is a human experience. This is when the stressors of life pile up, it's normal, it's natural, it's understandable, it's human to wonder. I wonder. And again, this is just our mind trying to make sense. Our minds are always saying, why? What does that mean? Why? Our minds are just going. A funny quote that I heard that has stuck with me, it's something about thoughts, because we have so many of them and we don't make them. Our brain is just going. Someone said, your brain produces thoughts like your mouth produces saliva. And when, you know, you're at a restaurant, Cantor's, and I'm waiting for my food to come, and you see, right? Or you hear the ding, the number, and your mouth starts to salivate.
Right.
Now, we don't sit around in front of the microwave when my eggs, turns out you can microwave eggs. When you microwave, it's not very good. When the microwave ding goes off, our mouth starts to salivate. But how many of us, I suggest very few, if anyone, says, oh, my stupid mouth, salivating, getting ready for this meal. How could you do that? Now, we don't talk about that organ, so to speak, in that way, but many of us do sit or consider like, oh, these thoughts again. So our mouth produces thought, or excuse me, our brain produces thoughts like our mouth produces saliva. And so I just wanted to share that having thoughts of suicide does not mean that anyone is broken. It doesn't mean that anyone's fundamentally flawed. And again, I hope that can help for the loved ones and the friends who are talking. And yes, it can be jarring. It can be activating. It can be scary to hear someone say, you know, I just don't even know. I mean, I got fired and I'm alone now. And I was thinking about getting a dog, but what's the point? You know, that instead of saying to them, like you said earlier, instead of saying, you know, I see this beautiful person in front of me. And if you could only see what I see, no. That's, you know, there's a difference between sympathy and empathy. And again, Brené Brown talks about this a lot, but instead of the golden rule, you know, treat other people the way that you would like to be treated. Mm-hmm. I think this would be a good example of the platinum rule. And the platinum rule goes like this. Instead of treat other people the way that you would like to be treated, the platinum rule says, treat other people the way that they want to be treated. So if someone is in a dark place or in a dark hole, instead of telling them, I see you as this beautiful shining, no. We say, you know what? Seems like you're really in a dark, dark place, and I'm so glad you're talking about it. And you know what? I've felt this way too. I've felt really, really dark at times too, and I'm so glad you're talking about it. Now, back to your first question, and then I'm gonna shut up. Is what do we do at the end of the conversation? And at that point, for sure, I would say to people, or if my friend or family member was having these kind of thoughts and sharing it with me, I'd say, I'm so glad you're sharing this with me. And by the way, this is something that so many of us experience. So number one, you're not alone, even though this is a big taboo topic for many years. So I would say, you know, are you talking to anybody regularly the way that you and I are talking? Who in your life knows this is how you feel? You know, for some people, yes, it could be a therapist. For some people, it could be a mentor. For some people, it could be a sponsor in a 12-step mm-hmm. program. See, I think that instead of pushing and I'm a therapist, right? But instead of pushing the therapist thing, and that's, therapists are great. I mean, we're great. We're great. But instead, I think let's keep in mind that what makes therapy work when it does, which is the safety, the sense of rapport and trust and caring. And so who in your life can you talk to the way that we've been talking here for the past 20 minutes? And if there's no one, then I would say, well, why don't we work together? Because these things deserve to be said. Your stories, your truth, your grief, your suffering, and the suicide crisis hotline, which I'll say the number now, and maybe you could post it as well. It's 1-800-273-8255. So that's 1-800-273-8255, or TALK, the last four numbers are TALK, sure. TALK. So people who are suffering can or in crisis or are stuck can call the crisis hotline. Family members and friends can call. It's really just it's the silence. And let's all just keep in mind that it's the silence and the disconnection that really drives suicidal thoughts and behaviors.
Okay. So moving, focusing specifically on divorce now. You know you want to get divorced, but you are married to somebody and you're extremely worried about them, that this could drive them over the edge. You already know diagnosed with depression. Maybe you're at that point. So let's talk to that listener who needs to get divorced. How do they handle their communication with their soon-to-be ex-spouse? And how do they handle justifying in their own head that filing for divorce could conceivably bring about the conclusion of this other person's life? This is a lot to deal with.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. This is a big one and an important one. Yes, many calls at the crisis hotline, many therapists like myself have conversations like this. Okay, my husband keeps saying that if I leave him, he will kill himself. What do I do? Okay, my wife, she's had some attempts when she was in her early 20s, and I'm really worried if I sign the paperwork that she might attempt suicide again. What do I do? I don't want to put my two kids through this. So this is really important. And again, none of us need to try to figure life out on our own. These are hard things to navigate. If I was in that position, I hope I would bring this up with someone who would listen, who would take the time to acknowledge this is really important, and not someone who would just say, just sign the paperwork. No. That's an example of what we were talking about before, which is just let me live your life for you. Let me tell you what to do. So back to this scenario, I think it's important to acknowledge as a kind of corollary or to the other side of the coin and what we were talking about before, that nobody can make anyone else do anything. So it's very important to emphasize that nobody can make someone else attempt suicide or die by suicide. So we want to keep that in mind too, that we are all in control of our own actions. And yes, I'm just thinking about the scenario where someone does die by suicide. And we've had many calls where people express this very concern, say, what if? And we can acknowledge that, you know, if that happens, you are not responsible for your husband's actions, your now ex-husband. I understand that it feels that way. You've been married for 7 years. Of course. And the things he said to you to try to keep you, and you said also that there were some other times in your relationship where he tried to, what felt like, manipulate you and try to get you using this kind of language. If you go away for this trip with your friends, you know, I'm going to start drinking again. You know, these kind of trying to manipulate. And so we can acknowledge that only he is in control of if he drinks or not, not you. Only he is responsible for his own actions. And if he makes an attempt, and not all people who attempt suicide die by suicide. It's important to say. There's a million attempts a year. There's about 50,000 deaths a year in the United States. There's a million attempts. Okay. Wow. So I just want to say that. But okay. So, yeah, your husband is responsible for himself. And if someone does die by suicide, that we can and we will grieve. And again, that deserves to be spoken about and shared and witnessed. But I think it's important to say that nobody can, it's not right. It's not fair to manipulate somebody using threats of suicide.
But do you really think, Brian, that the person who has genuine suicide ideation is manipulating? Are they just being who they are?
Well, when I brought up that example, I guess I was thinking to myself, okay, this is a time where someone is using that kind of language to try to maybe keep a marriage together. But there are people, and again, this goes back to what is driving suicidality or suicidal thoughts, which is the stressors of life piling up, feeling disconnected, feeling hopeless and helpless, a thwarted sense of belongingness, using Thomas Joyner, who's a leader in our field. He came up with this theory of the interpersonal theory of suicide. And saying to people, saying to a spouse or soon to be ex-spouse, you know, I'm concerned about you. I'm concerned. And you keep talking about your thoughts about harming yourself. And here is this phone number. And I just want to let you know that, yes, I'm concerned, but you need to take care of yourself and please talk to someone. You know, like at the very beginning of this conversation, you said that this is important when people say things. What do we do? How do we handle it? Suicide should, references to suicide should never be disregarded. You know, the boy who cried wolf, never. If somebody says something, even if it's a joke, we want to check. Hey, you know, I was listening to this podcast and I heard a guy talking about suicide, and he said that sometimes, when people are going through divorces and divorce proceedings, sometimes people have thoughts of suicide. Are you having any thoughts of suicide? You know, sometimes when people lose their job, it happens to so many of us, we lose our jobs. You know, sometimes when people get a diagnosis, they have thoughts of suicide. Is that something that you're experiencing? And it's always okay to ask. And when I was starting out, in this field, I really worried. I thought, oh my gosh, are people going to get mad if I ask? How dare you? How dare you ask me about my emotions and my life and my heart? The fact is, people are very grateful, often very grateful. And the answer might be yes, it might be no, it might be I don't know. But what has happened there is an example of connection, which is now that person who is suffering knows that you care, know that you see them, you really see them. Our intuition's always right. You know, it's always right about something, you know. And so if you care about someone, you can ask them, and then they may not be suffering in that way today, but maybe in 5 years from now, maybe in 10 years, and they might call you and say, hey, you know, I remember back in 2022, you asked me about feeling, you know, that way. Can we actually talk about that? Because I don't know, I just don't know what to do. And it turns out we don't need to do anything with people. Suicidal thoughts, suffering, it's not a problem to be solved. It's not a problem. It's suffering, it's emotions, it's storytelling, it's life. And we can actually say to somebody, yeah, I've got 10 minutes. Oh, for sure, I've got 20 minutes. Like, absolutely, let's get lunch. I want to hear more. And we can listen and we can nod. We can say, thank you. And we can say, wow, you must feel so overwhelmed and exhausted. And we can shut up. And we don't need to do anything, you know, in that moment. And then at the end of the lunch, we can say, you know, I'm so glad that you reached out. You know, also, I can relate to a lot of things you said today too. And I'm curious, who else knows what you're going through, you know? And I hope that you keep talking about this. I'm always going to be here for you. You deserve more connection.
So hang in there. That's not the divorce conversation. That's a different conversation. I need to focus on the divorce conversation.
Gotcha.
Where one spouse needs to get divorced and knows that the husband or wife, whomever, their other spouse is fragile, emotionally fragile. So the one thing that I got out of what you said, Brian, is file for divorce. You have to do what you have to do to live your life properly. But the other side of that, but the other component then of that is you do have to communicate with that person. If you're not going to hire attorneys who communicate with each other, which might be the right thing to do, just have the attorneys, if you have the money, communicate. But if you don't, and you want to do this with somebody like me, a legal document preparation company and a mediator, you are going to have to deal with that person. And if you have minor children, that whole custody thing is going to come up. Where is your soon-to-be ex-spouse on the depression continuum? Has that person attempted suicide before? What should you do about joint versus sole custody? How does that custody section get written? There's a lot of conversation that has to come up that is specific to divorce and the future. How do you do it?
Yeah, that means these are all important. You know, one or two things popped into my head when you were describing that example and just these types of scenarios. You know, I imagine there's often concerns about privacy, confidentiality, anonymity, what can be used against someone. Again, just going back to the crisis hotline, thank goodness for many decades now, there is a place that is confidential. Sometimes people prefer not to use their real names. Sometimes people will check in at the beginning of the call. Is this being recorded? Mm-hmm. Are you going to call the cops on me? Could this be subpoenaed? And this is a space where maybe there's a husband, maybe there's a wife, maybe there's kids involved. And so that partner, that spouse, soon to be ex, that they can call somewhere and talk anytime, as often as they want, to actually talk about what it's like to be going through these divorce proceedings. I got to go to court tomorrow. We got to meet with the mediator. I'm really, really scared. And I can't talk to my friends about this. I don't want to tell my lawyer. I don't want to call because I don't want to get charged for the call. You know, and I just want to say that I'm really, really worried. And I don't know if I can handle if tomorrow goes badly. Now, what that person will hear from us crisis counselors is compassion, listening, empathy. And also at the end of that call, we're going to remind that person, that husband or that wife, you know, this is really important what you're saying. And I want to let you know that you can call back anytime. In fact, maybe if you'd like, maybe we could call you back tomorrow after the hearing, after the session. You know, connection, again, it's true.
This is about what the other spouse, I really need to focus on this, Brian, because this is the hardest part of this conversation. And maybe this is, you know, an opportunity to rethink this and do a whole episode just on this. But it's very important, the spouse who is married to the one who's depressed, how does that spouse communicate? Decisions have to be made. They have to be able to communicate. How does that person do it who is worried about the mental health condition of the other spouse?
Yeah, no, and thank you. I'm glad that we could focus on that. And this is a big topic, so definitely worth revisiting in the future.
Yeah.
How do you communicate these important issues? Number one, that I would encourage people when communicating, spouse to spouse, saying that right now in the world, between COVID, between everything, the fact that you and I can have this conversation right now and it not be, you know, this will be allowed on the air, so to speak. Maybe there was a time where it wouldn't have been. Right now in the world, mental health is health. Mental health is health. We're talking about healthcare. We're talking about mental health is healthcare. So a husband talking to a wife talking to a husband, or husband to husband, wife to wife, saying, you know, this is important. I'm worried. We have three kids, okay? And part of being a parent, part of being in a relationship is we do model certain things, okay? And you do need to take care of yourself, okay? And so again, reminding people that I know you said that you're struggling. And as we separate, it is important that you continue to take care of yourself. And I hope this is addressing the question a little bit more directly, that reminding people, we're no longer married, okay? After tomorrow, we're no longer married. Officially.
Well, no, this is at the beginning.
Beginning. Okay. So we're at the beginning, and eventually soon, in however many months, we will no longer be married. It is very important that you take care of yourself. And I hear you saying that you're lonely. I hear you saying that you don't know how much longer you can go on without me and us and the kids. I want you to know that I've looked into it and I've done some research. And here are some phone numbers. And again, the Suicide Crisis Hotline is a great resource, not only for, I'm imagining, that person who's communicating with a partner who's suffering and suicidal, let's say. The Crisis Hotline is a place where people can call and brainstorm. Hey, I'm worried about my soon-to-be ex. What do I do? And we do talk through this. We talk about safety planning. We're talking about finding them referrals and therapy groups, 12-step programs. There is it is a place where we can collaborate. And also reminding everybody that we all got to take care of ourselves. And so while in a few months, we're no longer going to be married, you and I, I really hope that not only for the sake of your kids, our kids, but for your own sake, that you find someone that you can talk to about this. This is important.
Okay, so I'm going to do a twist on this, because in the field of divorce, I don't think that's going to happen. I think you need a place to talk about these issues with a professional in front of you. So here's what I would say, and I'd love your response to this. I would ask for I would ask to meet with that spouse in a therapist's office, so we could have the conversation with a licensed professional in front of us. I wouldn't do it with lawyers. I would do it with licensed therapists. Both people need to engage and have the conversation. And just because you have maybe a leaning towards, you know, suicide, maybe you haven't even attempted it, maybe the fear of attempting it, they still have to participate in the conversation. They just do. There's where I'm thinking as a non-therapist, that's where the connection's going to be. To not have a licensed professional as part of the conversation, in my mind, is just is just reinforcing the disconnection that the person who has suicide ideation already has. Go get yourself some help. There are people who are going to, how about, and unless this is being codependent, so I don't know, maybe I'm suggesting the wrong thing, to suggest that we have this talk about custody, the co-parenting plan, how we're going to handle things, should be done with somebody who is available in present time to participate in the conversation if we get lost.
That's a great point. Yeah, that's a good way to say it, if we get lost. And we all, and in conversations like this, it's quite natural to feel overwhelmed and get lost. Okay, now what do I say? What next? So having a professional, a mental health professional, somebody who is comfortable with these type of conversations.
And as you said earlier, not everybody is.
Not everybody. So when you're mm-hmm. when you're doing just like when you're interviewing an attorney and you want to make sure it's a good fit, you want to make sure that there's somebody who is right. You want to make sure that, okay, this is somebody I can work with. Likewise with therapists. Hey, so I want to have a session with my soon-to-be ex, and we want to talk about some of the mental health pieces as far as this divorce proceedings and how things proceed. How comfortable are you talking about suicide, safety planning, brainstorming? And some people might say, yeah, I'm very comfortable. I used to work at a crisis hotline when I was in grad school. Other people would say, you know what? I'm actually not. Good to know. So that when you do have a session and we can talk through these issues, okay, so, you know, husband, dad, I'm hearing from you both that you've had some attempts and you're saying, and you've come right out and said it, that a year after the divorce, if you're not married again, that you will attempt suicide. Is that right? Yeah.
Ah,
okay. Okay. So I'm glad we all know that now. So now so let's talk about that. And so I understand there's joint custody here. This is how this is, it seems like we're going to, so how do we both feel about this? So this suicide issue here at a year out, how are we going to navigate this for the sake of the kids, right? For the sake of this whole new normal that you all are living in now. And also, if that therapist gets it, and more of us get it now, that suicide, it means there's, in this example, him, it means that there is something in his life, maybe more than one thing, big stressors, big suffering, deep wounds. And these wounds don't heal by shoving them in the closet, burying them in the basement. Hopefully that therapist would say, you know, it's okay that you're thinking about suicide, Kevin. You know, you're not a bad man for thinking this. Okay, you're not broken. This is extremely difficult what you're going through. And how would you feel about meeting with someone and talking more about this? Because I can see on your face how hard this is. This is hard, and you don't need to walk through this alone. So that, again, connection. And it's not the responsibility in this case of the wife to do the heavy lifting and do the hand holding. And no, this is about, in this case, Kevin. This is about him.
You know, you said something a couple minutes ago, and that was checking in. I don't think it's such a bad idea to, once the divorce is final, and maybe this plan can be made while the decisions are being made for the co-parenting schedule, for us to come back and check in as co-parents. As unmarried co-parents, let's check in. How is this working for you? Are you feeling any better about the things that you were fearful about, concerned about, that you couldn't handle? How is it going? And maybe part of the mediation, the preparatory conversations before the settlement agreement can be, we will continue counseling as co-parents. So again, you're taking away the disconnection aspect. I'm leaving you, but I'm not really leaving you. I'm leaving you as your wife or husband, but I'm here as the co-parent. I'm not leaving you as the co-parent. We still have a relationship intact.
I love that. And these topics that maybe there's going to be a time when the kiddos are 15, 17, 13, 11, 8. I think the youngest call we've ever gotten at the hotline in Los Angeles was 7, I think.
Oh my God.
7 or 8. So I know parents want to have these type of conversations. It's hard. So hard. We get calls from parents all the time. How do I talk to my 10-year-old about this?
Wow.
How do I talk to my 18-year-old?
You know what? I'm glad you brought that up because we're at the end of our time, but I hadn't even thought about the kids as a result of the parents' divorce could go into this depression.
Sure. And even though maybe next time we can talk more about that, and just with respect to the parents here, maybe there'll be a time, maybe in 6 months, maybe in 3 years from now, when even they're co-parenting, no longer married, and one of the children is struggling. Maybe they just got dumped the day before prom. Maybe they just got a bad haircut. We get calls from people all the time who say, I got a bad haircut.
And listen, I'm thinking, it works for me. The bad haircuts are hard.
It's really hard. And so parents want to talk to the kid. Now, maybe that parent calls a crisis hotline, talks to a counselor like me or like us. You know, there's an opportunity there for the parent, co-parenting at this point, to have not telling that teenager how to feel about their bangs, not telling them what to do about being dumped. There's more fish in the sea. No, but to actually sit there and say, you know what? Thank you for saying that. And I can see on your face how dark and how hopeless this is. And you know what? I got to tell you that many of us, myself included, I've been there. And it's hard to talk about it, but I want you to know that we all can feel hopeless and helpless and disconnected at times. And I'm so glad you're talking about it. And I don't know if you've talked to any of your friends about it yet. I don't know if you've talked to any counselors about it, but I just want to let you know that me too. And again, we get a lot of calls from parents that want to practice these conversations and want to brainstorm. But if we all think about these things, but we're not allowed to talk about it, mm-hmm. then surely by practicing, by thinking, by listening to this podcast, by speaking with like-minded people, we can actually start having these conversations. And it turns out that there's opportunities, again, for growth, whether it be helping our children, helping our exes and co-parents navigate difficult times. Because as one of the founding fathers of suicide said, as I mentioned before, Schneidman, Farbrow, and Lippmann, one of them said, and it's a short little quote, but it's true. He said, it's a bad idea to kill yourself when you're suicidal. It's a bad, bad idea because it's a bad idea to kill yourself when you're suicidal. You know, it's the feelings will pass. The anger, the regret, the judgment, the shame, it passes. How does it pass? Goes back to the quote that you brought up. Connection. When we can share something with someone else, when we can hear ourselves talking, when we can actually hear ourselves say out loud, I just don't know how much longer I can last. And instead of just thinking it up here in the debate society in our mind, we can actually hear it in our own voice. And again, suicide is not about wanting to be dead. That's not what this conversation is about. This is about when the pain of being alive is so great, is that we just don't know how much longer we can go on. And it's connection, 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 connection.
And that is a perfect place to end this episode. Brian, for people who would like to get in touch with you, and I can't imagine if they would not, I will put this in show notes, but go ahead and say it on
Sure. I will give my work cell phone number, and I could also give you all the information that you can post and thank you. So my work cell, anybody can call me anytime, and I'll call you back, leave a voicemail, is 213-760-0621.
Say it again.
213-760-0621. And you can call, you can text, and I'll provide you, Judith, more information about websites and other contact information. And thank you, thank you, thank you. And to be continued.
To be continued, without a doubt. There's so much more to discuss. So, Brian, I appreciate that. Have a wonderful year. We're at the beginning of the year now, and we have a lot of work to do. And to all of you listening, thank you so much. I do this so that it's helpful to the greatest number of people going through divorce. Please give the name of this podcast, The Amicable Divorce Expert, to your friends. Spread the word. You may reach me through the through my email, judith@theamicabledivorceexpert.com, judith@theamicabledivorceexpert.com. Check out the blog on my website of the same name. And as always, have an amicable day.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.